Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We are now at the beginning of our fifth season, but we remain just as excited as ever to continue to help you explore and understand that unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of the planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here are issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, digestive issues and gut health, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen to today as we interview experts for today's show on climate change, the impacts of climate change, and how we're adapting and mitigation strategies. Now, climate change is indeed one of the most pressing issues of our time. It's a global problem that affects all of us, and it requires a concerted effort from everyone in order to mitigate its effects. It's a complex issue that affects everyone in different ways. Climate change is indeed not a distant threat reserved for future generations. It's happening now, impacting our daily lives in ways that we might not even realize. And so the urgency for action has never, ever been greater. But because the people we most often hear talking about climate change are not usually our friends and our neighbors, it seems often that we perceive it to be a distant concern, obscured by scientific jargon and global policy discussions. However, its effects are much closer to home than we might think. Rising temperatures, extreme weather events, and shifting ecosystems directly influence our health, our well-being, and the communities that we all call home. So while collective action has never been more urgent, as ordinary individuals navigating our everyday lives, it's crucial to understand not only the environmental impact of climate change, but also how it directly affects our health and well-being. Climate change is, again, no longer a distant threat. Its effects are palpable and can be seen each and every day in our lives. And so here are some ways that climate change can affect each of us personally. From water scarcity, climate change can cause droughts and water shortages, which can affect the availability of clean water for drinking, cooking, and sanitation. Extreme weather events. Climate change can cause more frequent and severe weather events such as hurricanes, floods, and wildfires. In each region, we have our own thing or our own extreme weather event. And these events can cause property damage, power outages, sickness and diseases, and even a loss of life. And then there's the other health risk. Climate change can lead to spread of diseases such as malaria and dengue fever, as well as respiratory problems. And then there's food security. It can affect crop yields and food production, which can lead to food shortages and higher prices and other issues. And then there's the economic impacts. Climate change can and does have significant economic impacts, such as increased insurance premiums, higher energy costs, reduced tourism, and even cause what we're now seeing and what we now realize are climate refugees. So take a moment to consider the air we breathe. With climate change, air quality is at risk due to the increased pollution and the exacerbation of respiratory illnesses. The frequency and intensity of heat waves are rising, and those pose severe health risks, especially in urban areas. So by understanding how climate change impacts our daily lives, we can better appreciate the vital importance of global initiatives that seem obscure and they seem totally irrelevant to us as we come and go about our daily lives, such as the upcoming COP28 that's happening in Dubai in about 5 or 6 weeks. And we're going to talk a lot more about this during the show. What is crucial, though, is to connect the dots between our individual actions, the broader community, and the global stage. Our everyday choices, from the products we buy to the energy we consume, contribute to the larger narrative of climate change. Global meetings like the COP meeting, again in about 5 or 6 weeks, play a global role in aligning nations and setting the stage for the necessary collective action. Again, climate change indeed is a global problem that requires global solutions. Imagine a world where nations are isolated in their response to climate change, with each nation pursuing their own interest without collaboration. The consequences would be dire, with uneven burdens placed on different regions and global progress hindered or stunted, because indeed the air does not stop at the country borders. We've all experienced at one time or other what we experience usually annually here in North Texas, and that's that Saharan red dust that obscures the skies and turns things red. So just imagine in each of our own little worlds that if that dust can come all the way from the Saharan desert in Africa over to North Texas, to Boston, or to LA, it can go anywhere. So again, though, as individuals, we have a role to play by advocating for ambitious climate goals and supporting the global initiatives. Our individual voices matter. And by demonstrating a collective commitment to change, then we can influence both local and global policies. Now, this is a lot, but here today to help us explore and unpack some of this are two experts who are going to make us smarter. With us today, we have David McGlinchey. David leads policy and government relations work at the Woodwell Climate Research Center, which is based in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Dave engages with congressional climate leaders as well as with local congregations and at the UN Climate Change Conference. He has worked with Woodwell scientists in the field, from a permafrost monitoring station in interior Alaska to a tropical forest research station on the southern edge of the Amazon. And early in his career, he launched the Vineyard Power Cooperative on the island of Martha's Vineyard to develop offshore wind projects with direct benefits to local communities. Welcome, Dave. We're so glad you could take time to be with us today. And did I get all of that right?
Yes, absolutely, Bernice. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Our other guest is Michael Oppenheimer. Michael is a professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University, and he's director of the Center for Policy Research on Energy and the Environment at Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Michael has been an author of reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which is with us, representatives and various authors are with us every year as we try to unpack some of their various reports. And they'll be with us again probably in February. Michael has been an author of reports of the IPCC on climate change, and he was author of one of the reports which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. He is co-editor-in-chief of the journal Climactic Change. Michael is a science advisor to the Environmental Defense Fund, and much of his work has centered on defining the concept of, quote, dangerous climate change, a key aspect of the UN's framework on climate change, as well as the Paris Agreement. Welcome, Michael, and did I get all of that right?
Got all of it right, and thank you for inviting me to join you today.
Thank you so much for being here. And we only have a few minutes before we have to go to break, but Michael, I want to go back with you on one of the things that kind of intrigued me on your bio, and that is defining the concept of dangerous climate change. What do you mean by that?
There's a treaty. The first global climate treaty was called the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, signed at the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in 1992. And Article 2 of that convention says that it's the obligation of the governments and the long-term objective of this first climate treaty to avoid, quote, dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. That means, in plain English, human beings should not mess too much with the climate by emitting too much greenhouse gases. Now, in many people's opinion, we've already gone too far, but it's also the case that at the Paris Climate Summit in 2015, countries agreed on a target of trying to limit the global warming since pre-industrial times, say late 19th century, to well below 2 degrees Celsius, which is about 4 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than it used to be in the 19th century. And if we try really hard, around 3 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're already more than 1.2 degrees Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than that time. So we're getting very close to the limits of danger that the governments themselves defined 8 years ago, based on the science and also the idea of feasibility. That means we better get cracking, or else we're going to blow past that threshold. And that means that it just gets riskier and riskier very, very fast to be subject to Earth's climate, which we all are.
Do we have a sense when we talk about, quote, dangerous climate change? In my mind, and I imagine a lot of people's minds, that's at the point at which we can no longer exist on Earth. How does your definition of dangerous climate change interface with that kind of common definition in our minds?
Well, dangerous in this case means it's too hot in many places for people doing normal outdoor activity like construction work, agriculture, kids playing soccer to survive. They could die just from the combination of heat and humidity. Dangerous means that it rains so heavily sometimes due to climate change that people, you know, drown during normal activity. For instance, in New York City, in the summer of 2021, 13 people drowned in their own bedrooms. Some of them were probably sleeping because they live in below-grade apartments.
Indeed, I remember that. I'm going to need to stop you. We're going to go to break, but we'll be right back on the other side to talk about this thing that just came up, and that is trying to get our heads wrapped around what really is dangerous climate change. Thank you. We'll be right back on the other side. I want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, all central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care. Practicing dentistry for over 38 years, non-mercury with a holistic approach, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Our other sponsor is the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is based on the research of nutrition pioneer Dr. Weston Price, whose studies established the parameters of human health and determined the optimum characteristics of human diets. The Weston A. Price Foundation is a member-supported organization, and they are looking forward to their annual conference for 2023, and it is called Wise Traditions. And here, over 1,200 attendees gather for learning, demonstrations, exhibits, and speakers, as well as very impressive, delicious, nutritious meals that embody the principles of the Weston A. Price Foundation. For more information and to register for the conference, check them out at wisetraditions.org. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, to today's show on the impacts of climate change and how we're adapting and looking at mitigation strategies. And we are back with Dave McClinchy with Woodwell Climate Research Center and Dr. Michael Oppenheimer with Princeton's School of Public and International Affairs. And again, thank you all so much for being with us today. And before the break, Michael, you were telling us about dangerous climate change, which is a rabbit hole I didn't mean to get off on, but I thought it was really important what we mean there and for us to kind of wrap our heads around. And I think basically we're talking about climate change wherein it's so hot outside that we can't, it's hard for us or it's dangerous for us to really like come and go in all of these extreme weather events that we just can't control. And again, we'll get a lot more into that later as we begin to discuss this. But while I'm with you, Michael, wanted to start with you and ask you, I see that early in your career, you were an astrophysicist. So what led you to become interested in climate change?
Well, a number of things. First of all, I read an article in the alumni magazine of MIT, where as an undergraduate in 1969, had been an undergraduate. By 1969, I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And the article basically laid out what the risks of climate change were very well. And I tell you, I'm not an easy person to scare, but it did frighten me. And I put it in the, back of my mind, because there was nothing I could do about it at that point. I was, a 22-year-old graduate student. And I focused on my graduate studies, but it turned out that my advisor was one of the early people, early scientists, getting into understanding how you could use chemistry to solve the air pollution problem, which was starting to spread in the Los Angeles area, in the Midwest, and on the in the big East Coast cities. And activism, it was terrific and very energizing. And then through the 1970s, as the early successes of the environmental movement piled up, I got involved in a minor way in some of those things. In particular, I took a backpacking trip to one of the remote parts of Alaska. It's now the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. And I came back and was asked to testify in Congress about how unique that was and why we should avoid oil and gas drilling in that part of the world. And it became part of the mandate in the Alaska Lands Act, which is what divided up the land between the federal and state government. And actually, not just my testimony, of course, but that of me and a lot of other people, actually influenced the outcome and preserved a lot of wild land. And that kind of gave me the feeling I could do something more related to helping people than astrophysics, which is interesting, but kind of remote. So in 1981, I decided to become a scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund. And that's where I got very deeply involved in climate change, acid rain, air pollution, and some other issues where a scientist could make a real contribution.
Indeed. Thank you for that. I want to move to you now, Dave. How do you see climate change currently impacting global ecosystems? And what are some of the specific examples of these impacts that your research has highlighted?
Thank you, Bernice. The impacts that, climate change is going to impact ecosystems in a variety of ways, from the ways that we kind of enjoy and experience ecosystems to biodiversity. But the impact that we study most here at the Global Climate Research Center and the ones that I worry about the most are climate change threats to large stores of terrestrial carbon. That's carbon that is locked up on Earth, like in tropical forests, the carbon that's in trees and soils, and in the Arctic, carbon that is stored in permafrost, which is the permanently frozen ground up there.
Would that also be applicable to carbon stored in like Central Park or big urban forest or other places like that too? No, those places.
Yeah. No, carbon is carbon. It's okay. The same carbon, but the quantity is so much greater if you're thinking about the tropics and you're thinking about the Arctic. For example, there's 1.4 trillion tons of carbon stored in Arctic permafrost. As climate change impacts are being seen, those huge pools of carbon in the Arctic and in the tropics in those ecosystems are being disturbed and they're emitting into the atmosphere. And so we already have to think about and worry about carbon dioxide emissions from human activities, from the cars we drive, from factories, from generating power. But that's also leading to this kind of follow-on effect of causing permafrost thaw emissions or causing emissions from tropical forests.
Let me stop you there, Dave, though, and ask you. So we've got these large stores of carbon that's stored in the permafrost and in the tropical forest. What happens when those are released, or what could happen when those are released? And the question I like to ask, why should we care?
We should care because we have global climate models. They kind of, Michael was talking earlier about targets we're trying to stay underneath. We're trying to stay under 2 degrees Celsius worth of warming. And we know generally how much carbon we can continue to emit, what our budget is to stay under that threshold. But if you factor in emissions from these natural systems, that budget changes dramatically. So for example, over the next, between now and 2100, on its current track, permafrost thaw, like just Arctic areas emitting from soils, could equal essentially the equivalent of another United States, add another United States worth of emissions into the world. And so we should care, because the longer we allow kind of human activities to emit greenhouse gases and continue to warm the atmosphere, the more we are prompting these additional emissions from natural systems. And so the effect becomes compounded. We have essentially, the word tipping points is concerning because people think of kind of going off a cliff, and I don't think it's exactly like that, but it is something to be concerned about kind of creating such a spiral and kind of a circular effect that we can't control it anymore.
I think one of my guests last week, she used the term feedback loop, and that sounds like maybe a little what you're talking about. The things that we individuals do to cause the climate to warm are exacerbating those big stores. It's really exacerbating letting loose those big stores of carbon like in the Arctic. And I think bringing it back to kind of connect the dots or let everyone relate to it, you know how we all see the commercials on television with the polar bears and they're walking on a little piece of ice, but it's obvious it's melting and they're making a plea for funding, probably, I think, from the WWF. But I think that's what most of us think about when we think about the melting permafrost and the melting Arctic. But what you're saying is what we're doing is causing a lot of that to happen. And when that happens, it's going to be certainly, when you say that, dangerous climate change.
A feedback loop is exactly the right term, Bernice. I wasn't going to jump to it directly, but yeah, it is a feedback loop. And that's what we study carefully here at the Woodwell Center and something we're concerned about.
I want to go to you now, Michael. What do you see, though, in your work as the most significant impacts of climate change that we are currently experiencing? And I say currently experiencing really pretty much as individuals.
Well, in the United States, and I think worldwide, the primary weather-related cause of death, extreme heat, and we're getting it hotter and hotter. Now, I feel like the States where, you know, as I said, people die from extreme heat. A lot of people, but not everybody, can afford air conditioning, is smart enough to stay inside when it's too hot, and may or may not be able to keep up with the increase in heat. But there are a lot of people in this country and many more abroad who can't afford air conditioning, who are stuck in many countries that are living out on the streets as the only way to stay cool, sleeping out in the street in hot weather. It's a problem which falls unequally both between rich countries and poor countries, but also within the rich countries like our own across different populations. That kind of gap has to close, and we're doing a bad job of it right now. For instance, although we sort of privatized the act of adaptation to heat, extreme heat, buy an air conditioner, we don't have many programs which actually subsidize sufficiently so that poor people can get air conditioning. We don't have what are called cooling centers, which are places that people can go in hot weather to cool off. They're not located in ways that are actually accessible to people who, for instance, maybe don't own a car or can't afford to own a car or too old or sick to own a car. Those kinds of inequities penetrate the entire, quote unquote, system of adaptation in the United States. And that's the first thing that something needs to be done at. The Biden administration is making some progress in that regard, and that's encouraging, but there's a long way to go.
We're going to go ahead and go to break right now, and we'll be right back on the other side with Dave McClinchy with the Woodwell Climate Research Center and Dr. Michael Oppenheimer with Princeton's Center for Policy Research on Energy and Environment at the Public and International Affairs School. Thank you all. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today, to today's show on climate change, the impacts of climate change, and how we're adapting and mitigation strategies. And we're back with Dave McClinchy and Michael Oppenheimer, and they are indeed making us smarter. So I want to start this segment back with Dave. Dave, in the face of ongoing climate change, what adaptation strategies do you see as particularly promising are effective for ecosystems and communities? And what do you consider perhaps to be some of the most innovative approaches that are being explored right now?
Bernice, I think the key and the most fundamental step to adaptation is understanding the problem. And we are fortunate that climate science and climate risk modeling can give us a fairly accurate picture of what impacts are going to look like in coming decades. And that's true for a variety of hazards, heat, precipitation, sea level rise. We generally know how these are going to unfold. But informing local communities about what that looks like is a critical step if, you know, invest in the right adaptation measures. So I would say the most innovative work being done right now is understanding and informing on the issue, on the type of risks that people will be facing.
That's our purpose, too, here at Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, is to help educate and inform people about the various environmental issues, chief of which is climate change, or all of which feed into climate change. Because as you said, education is the key. And then when people understand it and they see how it impacts them, then hopefully they will be sensitized and move to action. So thank you for that.
I mean, I was just going to add, it's not just education. It's very specifically under what the issues are. So if you're thinking about to build a higher ceiling to change the design of a building, or you need to, in some cases, relocate the community, education is important in terms of making people aware. But very specific, actionable risk science is critical to adaptation. Sorry to interrupt.
No. Thank you for bringing that. Because, again, education, I think, though, is what gets people to move the systems and the institutions a lot faster, or should I say, move them at the speed that they need to be moved, is I think what needs to happen. Because one of the things, but let me go ahead and ask Michael this, because I've got some strategies that I want to talk about specifically too. But Michael, how can we adapt to these impacts, and what are some of the most effective strategies for building resilience?
Well, the first thing you do is do the things that are easy and cheap. And when you think about it, it's hard to believe that there are a lot of things we leave on the table that we should have taken off a long time ago. Protecting critical infrastructure. Where I live, there was a hurricane 10 years ago that caused real damage, Hurricane Sandy, and the lights went out. And the reason the lights went out were not that the utility poles went down, the wind wasn't that strong. There was a surge from the ocean, flooded the city, and that the substations of the electric power company here were built right along the banks of the rivers that go right into the ocean. So the surges came up river and flooded them. Nobody had thought about protecting them with, you know, walls that are, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 feet high. At the same time, they had the emergency equipment. A bunch of the hospitals were located along the estuary too, and the surge got into them. And the emergency equipment and the fuel for the emergency equipment in the basement. So when the out for the central generating system of the city, there was no backup, and they had to evacuate the hospitals. And luckily, nobody died. It's stuff like that that needs to be thought about in advance.
In relation to what you just said, I want to ask you a critical question. Now, 10 years on from Sandy, what has been done?
Well, there's been a fair amount done because it wasn't hard to do it in the first place. The city code now doesn't allow hospitals to be situated right on the coast. The city code doesn't let any new infrastructure of a critical nature be situated in the flood zone. It's now necessary for the utilities have started building better flood protection. It's the easy stuff is actually getting done. The harder thing is the long-term plan. It's expensive, and we have to think ahead decades because, hey, we have to get finance together, the plans, finance, and the political agreement to do it. And that's things like actually building big, for instance, surge barriers, which protect, whether it's Charleston, South Carolina, or Galveston, or New York City, or New Orleans. Some of those places have such protection, some don't, but they cost billions. They cost tens of billions. Where do you do it? And where do you just say people have to gradually move away? There's time to do both of those if we start now. If we diddle around for 10 or 20 years while sea level is rising because of climate change, we're going to run out of time, and then we won't be able to get the resources together quickly to do it before the next huge storm comes along.
I think this is where we the people, individual action comes too, because it seems like you guys are doing some significant resilience type activities there. But then you look at places like South Florida, where 14 years ago, before I left there, water was just still coming up in the streets in South Beach without a drop of water coming from the sky. And they're still allowing people to build along the coastlines.
Well, that's a good, interesting example. There is no long-term plan to save the parts of Miami that are too low lying. What they're doing is this quick and easy stuff, which is building a better pumping system to get the water out when it comes in. But there's no plan to say how you're going to deal with the potential of a meter or more of sea level rise over the remainder of this century. And that's because it's expensive. It involves land use planning, probably preventing people from settling in some places, probably moving people out of certain other areas. And local cities, counties like to do that because it's tax base and it costs of money to build coastal defense if you want to protect the land and the tax base. And what we need ultimately are two things. One, new insurance formats, which actually, instead of what's happening in Florida now, which is the insurance system is falling apart, the state has to take it over, and the state doesn't have the money to insure everything against hurricanes, everybody. And so you need some kind of insurance system which gives people an incentive to do the right thing in advance, to not build in the wrong areas, to build resiliently if there's any kind of risk in areas that are relatively safe. And we don't have that going on in the United States right now. And secondly, we need a system of finance which lets the big government, the one that collects most of the tax revenue, the one in Washington, share that in a more sensible way with the state and local governments, which have the responsibility of doing a lot of this work on the ground in communities.
Indeed.
Until the federal government gets reorganized properly and shares the revenue appropriately, we're not going to get enough done.
What a move to you, though, Dave. Michael mentioned two things, finance and insurance. And I know that you are involved with past COPs, and again, COP is Conference of the Partners. I want to talk to you, or have you talk to us, about are these the kind of things that are discussed at the COP, which is a global platform? Are these the type of things that are discussed? And then briefly, though, before you answer that, just describe to people what the COP is again.
Absolutely. So to start with, COP is Conference of the Parties, and it comes from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it's essentially an annual together of every country, that treaty, to talk about or to move forward on global climate policy. It moves slowly. Statements that come out of COP are designed to be consensus statements. Every word has to be agreed to. So they tend to be
bulky,
not as kind of aggressive.
Yeah.
A lot of people would like them to be, given the urgency of the problem. But it's our annual kind of international climate policy coming together is the best way I would think about it.
Okay.
And we do think about things and discuss things like climate finance there, particularly in the context, though, given that it's an international climate conference, of how to develop finance mechanisms for developing countries to kind of both deal with change impacts and to increase their mitigation strategies. That's a big part of the conversation there, and it has seen some progress in recent years. What I'm hoping for this year, though, is some progress on adaptation and loss and damage conversations, because the impacts that we've been talking about in this conversation are happening now. They're going to get worse in coming decades, but they're happening right now. There are countries that are not equipped to deal with these impacts, whether that be kind of, you know, low-lying Pacific Island countries or, you know, Central African tropical forest countries. And there's conversations that we hope move forward about kind of the countries that have caused most of this problem, that have emitted most of these greenhouse gases, developing mechanisms to support the more impacted areas of the world.
And I want to ask you, and we have 1 minute to go. I will ask it, and then we'll really deal with it more on the other side. What you just mentioned about the developing countries feeling most of the impact and us in the developing world causing a lot of it. And that conversation is out there a lot. We hear a lot about that. But after the break, I want to talk to you about, and let's have this discussion starting with you, and we'll bring in Michael too. Why should people who do not perceive that this affects them, because we're here in the U.S., why should they care about it? So we're going to go to break, and we'll be right back on the other side with Dave McClinchy and Michael Oppenheimer, and they are indeed making us smarter. Want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care. Practicing dentistry for over 38 years, non-mercury with a holistic approach looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. And our other sponsor is the Weston A. Price Foundation. Based on the research of nutrition pioneer Dr. Weston Price, whose studies established the parameters of human health and determined the optimum characteristics of human diets. The Weston A. Price Foundation is a member-supported organization, and they are looking forward to their annual conference in Kansas City, and it is called Wise Traditions, where nearly 1,200 attendees gather annually for learning demonstrations and delicious, nutritious meals that embody the principles of the Weston A. Price Foundation. For more information and to register for the conference, visit wisetraditions.org. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on climate change, as we focus on the impacts of climate change and how we're adapting as well as looking at mitigation strategies. And we are back with Dave McClinchy with the Woodwell Climate Research Center and Michael Oppenheimer with Princeton School of Public and International Affairs and Director of the Center for Policy and Research on Energy and Environment. And again, thank you all for being with us because you really are making us smarter. Now, right before the break, I was asking Dave to talk to us about why we should care about the developing countries in our world who are overburdened with the impacts of climate change and with these impacts that are indeed being caused by us developed nations. Talk to us a little bit about that. And then I don't want to leave this conversation, Dave, without talking about climate refugees.
Absolutely, Bernice. I think the first thing I'd say is that we should care because we live in a truly interconnected world. Impacts that we see in developing nations spread and impact their neighboring countries and then, you know, regions and the global situation. And you mentioned climate refugees. Climate migration is a real concern and issue as certain areas of the world become too hot to live in, as it becomes uninhabitable. People will move. They're not just going to sit there and suffer through it. They will move. And when they do, you know, that creates a situation that needs to be handled somewhere else. And so we need to care about that because we need to anticipate. We need to set up the systems that can support these folks. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, earlier we talked about the importance of tropical forests. Keeping tropical forests intact is absolutely critical for a stable climate. We have to decarbonize. You know, we have to reduce emissions from human activities, but we need to keep it intact. If we don't support these countries, especially the kind of high levels of poverty, they're going to deforest. They're not going to keep those forests intact. They're going to find other ways to make money off that those trees, and that puts us in a real tough spot in terms of a stable climate.
And that seems to be happening already. I have heard various people on our show make the case that a lot of the global nationalism that we're seeing and experiencing in our world today, from the U.S. with migration from Central America and other countries, as well as other countries, that a lot of that is indeed the root cause, rather, is climate change issues. As the people migrate from these countries where they can no longer make a living or where their homes are no longer safe and they're no longer safe, then they begin to go to other countries and other countries are fighting that. Michael, you look like you want to comment on that.
Yeah, we do. In my research group, we do quite a lot of work on the question of the relationship of weather and climate to migration. And some of the outstanding cases of migration that caused difficulties in recent years, including the Syria situation, where a large number of migrants moved into Europe, and the situation at the U.S. border that's ongoing. Climate is a factor. It's not the major factor, but it makes an already tenuous situation worse. So, for instance, in Syria, the people were moving already into the urban areas that, where there was political instability partly as a result, and the civil war that that resulted wasn't because of climate change, but the fact that there was a long-term drought made the situation worse. The same thing is sort of seems to be happening in Central America, where there is, again, long-term drying, which we can, by the way, expect to continue and get worse in the future. But what's really the prime cause are corrupt and dangerous governments, drug gangs, and general political instability. And then you combine that with weather events like drying or the occasional disastrous hurricane, and you get a situation where if people were moving in the first place, they're even going to more likely move then. And the thing for the future is that governments have an obligation to think about this. This is going to happen more and more. People have always moved due to climate and weather, and they're going to move more in the future in all probability. But to try to identify where that's going to happen in general, the regions in advance, so you can have policies which make it easier for people to move without taking their lives at risk, easier for the people that are left behind, or if possible, you make it easier for people to stay where they are in the first place by this program of making it easier for them to adapt to the changing climate where they are. We're going to see a combination of all those, and it's very important that governments think ahead and that we get it right.
Indeed, and it's critical, because I think it's absent, that just ordinary people in their everyday lives understand this impact of all this migration, that they understand the impact of climate change on all this migration. It is like the fuel that seems to be creating that perfect storm.
Yeah. By the way, one another thing you could do is make it easier. If people are going to move, if you're going to let them move into certain places, to make it easier for the people that are already there. Instead, we have situations that the governments ignore until it's too late and it becomes chaotic. And that's not good for anybody.
Dave, I want to ask you, though, what do you see as some of the key challenges, though, in mitigating climate change? And how is the Woodwell Climate Research Center contributing to the development and implementation of effective mitigation strategies? What are y'all doing to help us?
You know, Bernice, I would say the biggest challenge right now is political. We know a lot of the things we need to do. Michael talked about a lot of them earlier. There's upgrades we need to do in terms of the way we generate electricity, the way we generate power, the way we, you know, our electrical grid needs to be upgraded. But the biggest challenge is finding common ground politically. The good news, though, I think, is that we are at a point, and maybe we're here because you can't ignore the headlines. You know, you come out of a remarkable summer of heat and climate-driven weather events. You can't ignore the headlines, but we're at a moment of kind of remarkable consensus that something is happening and it needs to be addressed. You have corporations we work with who 10 years or 5 years ago tiptoed around this subject, and now they have, you know, a chief climate officer or whole divisions that are focused on climate change. That's a remarkable shift in a fairly short amount of time. And you see the same thing, I think, in society. A lot of people are really aware. Now, the question is kind of coalescing around some common ground in terms of policy movement. You know, what can we all agree to in terms of moving forward?
You know, I was talking with some colleagues who do things similar as this as we're doing. And we all wonder, as we're talking about climate change, trying to educate, trying to inform, how do we measure the difference we're making? And I imagine you guys ask yourselves some of the same things. And we kind of determine that you're making a difference by talking about it. And I think you kind of alluded to that. As it's talked about more and more often, you've got the companies who are buying in the politics. But it's also absolutely necessary that us everyday people in our everyday lives buy into it, too, so that we can push those institutions, we can push those political systems to take what they already know to be the necessary action. So I think that is happening. Yes.
Bernice, exactly what you're talking about. The reason corporations were nervous about speaking about climate change is because they thought there would be a backlash from their customers, from society. But as they kind of dipped their toe in that water, they realized not only was there not a backlash, people wanted to hear them talking about this. people were ready and they wanted to hear companies and politicians lead and kind of step forward on this. So I think you're absolutely right that it needs to be all of us, because we are the ones that will eventually drive decision makers, policymakers to make better choices.
Indeed. And I saw in your bio, too, that you speak to congregations, which I think is a good thing. And that takes me back to community engagement. How important is community engagement in addressing climate change impacts, which you talked about a little bit? But I want to ask you, are there any successful models or case studies where communities have really played an absolute crucial role in both adaptation and mitigation strategies? And quickly with that.
Yeah, really quick. In terms of adaptation strategies, community engagement is absolutely essential, because, you know, it's going to be unique and relevant to the local community, whether you're talking about planting urban trees to mitigate heat islands, whether you're talking about, in some situations, actually relocating a community. You need to have community engagement. In terms of mitigation, I think the key component of community engagement is siting new power generation. And that's obviously been a difficult topic for a long time. But seeing that in kind of inclusive way that actually engages the community increases the chances of success.
Indeed. And we just have 3 minutes to go. Michael, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most, you know, to end on an up note, there's a lot of good stuff going on. And, the most important thing that's happened on this front in the 40 years I've been paying attention to this issue is that there's now an energy revolution going on that is changing the way Americans produce and use energy, that is being appropriately supported with good level of resources from the government, that many communities are getting involved with in a way that's going to make it easier for the transition to occur. And, you know, one of these things, of course, when you have progress like that, when you have really a revolution going on in a good way, is that certain people try to stop it. So one of the most important things that individuals and communities do, make reasonable decisions. We need to get energy around by modernizing the electricity grid. Let's have a balanced approach which respects people's property rights, respects view sheds, but at the same time doesn't just blindly approach every bit of transmission line that's going to go into areas that brings in renewable energy and allows it to be deployed smartly and effectively so we can be very efficient in our use of it. Those are the kinds of things that people can get involved in politically at their individual community level. They should get active.
Indeed. Thank you for that. And thank you both for making us smarter. And I think you've really hit it, that people have to realize that they can and indeed do make a difference. And it's our lives that are at stake here. And Dave, I want to invite you back after you are in the Dubai COP to let us know a little bit. I like to call it the road from the COP. In other words, what significantly came out of that and why should we care and how it's going to affect us. And thank you both. We have been today with Dr. Michael Oppenheimer at Princeton University's Center for Policy Research on Energy and Environment, and Dave McClinchy with the Woodwell Climate Research Center. Thank you all. You really have made us smarter today. And thank you, listeners, for listening in today to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. The conversation starts here, but our goal is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is a result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day like yourselves. But each of those tiny acts can seem insignificant, but all of them add up, one way or the other, to the change that we each live through. This is your host, Bernice Butler. Thank you for listening today, and join us again next week for more on the economics of climate change. And listen to any of our past shows on podcast wherever you get yours. Thank you.